Due to the graphic nature of this cult's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of graphic material that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for listeners under 13.
The police raids often happened at midnight. The young Freedomite children hid in dark corners of their homes, hoping to evade the officers who arrived to take them away from their parents.
One six-year-old child's parents hid her under a hay-covered trap door. The child crouched, terrified, as the police poked at the hay with pitchforks.
The police found her, and she scrambled to escape. The child recalled, "You'd run like crazy, and at 6 years old, you were running. You're still running."
But she never got away. From 1953 to 1959, the Canadian government rounded up a total of 200 Freedomite children and imprisoned them in a filthy, overcrowded educational institution called New Denver.
The children would remember the horrors they suffered there for the rest of their lives.
One survivor confided, "I came to New Denver in 1953, taken away from my parents at 10 years old. I lost my childhood."
They were punished for the sins of their parents, the founders of the Freedomite cult. Hi, I'm Greg Polson.
And I'm Vanessa Richardson.
And this is Cults. Today we're going to take a deep dive into the Freedomites, an extremist sect that protested war through nude marches, arson, and bombings. If you want to listen to any previous episodes of Cults, you can find them on your favorite podcast directory or on our website, parcast.com.
And don't forget to subscribe while you're there, because a new episode comes out every Tuesday. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and on Twitter at Parcast Network. If you like what you hear, please leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening.
The Freedomites were originally members of a pacifist Christian religious group known as the Doukhobors, or Spirit Wrestlers. The Doukhobors fled Russia for Canada in 1899, after Emperor Alexander I ordered that they should be assimilated into mainstream Russian culture.
The Doukhobors rejected pageantry and priests. They led simple lives in communal farming villages in British Columbia, and they disapproved of nationalism, militarism, property ownership, and materialism.
The extremist Freedomites split from the mainstream Doukhobors in 1902. In the late 1920s, the Freedomites began a 40-year campaign of arson and bombing attacks on Canadian government facilities.
In the 1980s, the Freedomites' terrorist campaign fizzled out, thanks in part to Canadian government outreach, and the Freedomites were reabsorbed into the larger Doukhobor community.
There are about 20,000 descendants of the Doukhobors living in Canada today. Just over 6,000 still follow the religion. Most of the Freedomite children imprisoned by the Canadian government from 1953 to 1959 no longer follow their parents' religion, but they still want justice for the abuse they suffered. The Doukhobors formed in Russia in the 18th century. The pacifists were viewed with constant suspicion by the Russian government and the Russian Orthodox Church. The Doukhobors didn't believe in sitting through services conducted by priests. They were instead similar to the American Quakers. They believed that everyone should listen to the voice of God that they could hear speaking from within.
But that isn't their only similarity to the Quakers. Both groups are also pacifists. A recent psychological study has shown that pacifists may be motivated by feelings of disgust.
Vanessa's going to take over on the psychology here and throughout the episode. Please note, Vanessa is not a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist, but she has done a lot of research for this show.
Thanks, Greg. A study published in January 2012 in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology found that people who are disgusted by aggression are less likely to be violent towards both strangers and family members. Throughout the 19th century, Russia was embedded in a series of wars and skirmishes that both prevented invading nations from conquering their lands and pressed their empire further in Transylvania and the Caucasus region. Such regular exposure to warfare and civil unrest could have been what spurred their pacifist beliefs.
Over the course of the 1800s, the Dukhobors farmed their villages communally and maintained a simple agrarian lifestyle.
By the late 1800s, the Russian government was increasingly leery of the Dukhobor community. The Dukhobors' pacifism was in stark contrast to the rising militaristic and nationalistic ambitions of Russia's czars.
The Russian government became even more nervous in 1887, when 27-year-old Peter the Lord Lee Varagin rose to power amidst infighting in the Dukhobors' community over the appointment of their next community leader.
Charismatic, eloquent, and persuasive, Varagin was also sincere in his Dukhobor beliefs. His supporters hung on his every word and excitedly prepared for the January 1887 ceremony wherein he would be anointed their leader.
But Varagin's enemies in the Dukhobor community colluded with the Russian authorities to get rid of him. He was arrested on January 26, 1887, in the middle of his inauguration ceremony.
The Russian authorities exiled Varagin to Siberia for the next 16 years, but he was able to maintain his power over the Dukhobor community even in exile.
In 1893, he wrote his community a letter insisting on new religious restrictions. He told his followers to give up meat, alcohol, and material possessions. Not all of the Dukhobors heeded Varagin's call to vegetarianism, but most still accepted him as their leader. When Varagin wrote letters in the mid-1890s encouraging the Dukhobors to remain pacifist, the community followed his wishes.
But when the Dukhobors tried to burn their guns as an anti-war protest in 1895, it triggered a severely disproportionate response from the Russian authorities. The Tsar approved a horrific campaign of violence and terror against the Dukhobor community. From 1895 to 1899, Russian police exiled, mass arrested, raped, beat, and starved the Dukhobors. The Dukhobors began emigrating to Canada in 1899 in hopes of a better life.
Initially, life was peaceful and idyllic in Canada. After the first wave of 7,500 Dukhobors arrived in Canada in 1899, they were able to freely practice their religion and lifestyle.
Canada's Dominion Lands Act of 1872 permitted the Dukhobors to live in communal villages instead of privately owned homes, and Section 21 of the Dominion Military Act allowed the pacifist Dukhobors to avoid serving in the military.
But in 1905, Canada's new Minister of Interior, Frank Oliver, changed everything.
Oliver was both racist and xenophobic. He stole land from Canada's First Peoples, banned black people from immigrating, and rewrote laws aimed at disrupting the pacifist communal Dukhobor immigrant community.
Dukhobors were now required to live in private homes. They were also required to swear allegiance to the Canadian government and serve in the military.
These punitive laws radicalized a subsection of the Dukhobor community. This isn't surprising, since research has shown that a hostile environment alienates immigrants and makes them more susceptible to radicalization.
In 2017, two studies presented at the American Psychological Association's 125th Annual Convention revealed just how xenophobia can contribute to an immigrant's radicalization.
Sarah Lyons Padilla, the Stanford psychology research scientist who presented the studies, noted, quote, "In what has also been referred to as a vicious cycle of prejudice, we find that lower levels of openness to diversity are associated with lower levels of cultural integration. Difficulty integrating, in turn, shapes support for extremism," end quote. In other words, the hostility of the Canadian government only encouraged some members of the Dukhobor community to embrace extreme forms of protest.
In response to the new land laws, the Dukhobors organized a march from Yorkton to Winnipeg on October 29, 1902. Several of them stripped off their clothes, a precursor of the nude marches to come.
In November 1902, the Canadian government rounded up the marchers and shipped them back from Winnipeg to their homes in Saskatchewan. The Dukhobors' leader, Peter Varagin, was finally freed from his Siberian exile in 1902. He left Russia and joined his followers in Saskatchewan in the winter of that year.
Varagin didn't want his people to be persecuted the way they had been in Russia, So he proposed that the Dukhobors give in to the Canadian government's demand and become private property owners. Berrigan reasonably pointed out that Dukhobors could still live communally, even if they registered their lands as individuals. But not all of the Dukhobors were willing to compromise. In December of 1902, the group split into three factions.
A small group of Dukhobors called the Independents fully integrated into Canadian society in an effort to fit in. The Orthodox, comprised of the majority of the Dukhobor community, were willing to follow Berrigan and make concessions to the Canadian government.
But a small group of radicalized Dukhobors were unwilling to compromise their beliefs in the slightest. Instead of giving it to the government, they wanted to fight back. So, in December 1902, they formed their own sect, called the Freedomites, or Sons of Freedom.
It's not surprising that the Canadian government's harsh crackdown on the Dukhobors led directly to the formation of the radical Freedomite sect. According to Sarah Lyons Padilla's research, immigrants who feel alienated are often left searching for a purpose in life. Racism and xenophobia can leave immigrants feeling rejected, humiliated, and hopeless. Joining an extremist group can alleviate these feelings of shame and provide them with a sense of hope that is otherwise lacking in their lives.
The Freedomites found a new sense of purpose by protesting the Canadian government. And as the majority group of Dukhobors began to privately register their lands in May of 1903, the Freedomites organized their first nude protest.
By stripping off their clothes, they expressed their anger at the government and their distaste for material possessions. It was a way of provoking outsiders and showing their hostility without actually resorting to violence.
The Freedomites were also using nudity to compare themselves to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. They believed they were demonstrating their purity and humility before God.
The tradition of Christians taking off their clothes in protest against authority goes back farther than you might think. St. Francis stripped naked in public in front of his father and a bishop to demonstrate the sincerity of his faith. The Freedomites may have been attempting to follow in his footsteps.
But the Canadian government was unmoved by the Freedomites' nude protests. And in 1907, the government escalated its crackdown on the Freedomites. Officials announced that they were taking away any Dukhobor land that wasn't privately registered. This only served to further anger and radicalize the Freedomites. The sect actually grew stronger after 1907, numbering in the thousands.
Freedomites may have found solace in their radical beliefs. Religious scholars Rodney Stark and William Bainbridge have noticed that more extreme or high-tension religious sects tend to thrive, while moderate religious sects often fade away. This is because moderate religious devotees are more likely to abandon religion altogether and live secular lives, while strict religious devotees find their faith strengthened by segregating themselves from the secular world.
This seems to have been the case with the Freedomites. While many Dukhobors integrated into Canadian society, Freedomites became more extreme. By 1908, the formerly pacifist Freedomites were resorting to violence.
On July 16, 1908, 100 Freedomites got into a vicious fight with Canadian policemen sent to Saskatchewan to arrest them. The group pummeled the police with sticks for 3 hours, but the police managed to arrest the 12 Freedomites leading the protest.
That same year, in 1908, Berrigan bought land for the entire Dukhobor community in British Columbia, where they would be freer to continue their communal lifestyle. Even though the Freedomites were essentially their own sect at this point, they followed Berrigan and the other Dukhobors to British Columbia. The Freedomites settled in Slocan Valley, British Columbia, on land that Berrigan had purchased. There, they founded their own community, Crestova Village.
But the Freedomites only became more radical in the 1920s. The Freedomites felt alienated by an unfriendly Canadian government, and they believed the moderate majority Dukhobors were no longer religious enough.
Not only did they continue their nude marches, they also began committing arson. They burned down government buildings, their own homes, and even the homes of their moderate Dukhobor neighbors. When they set fire to their own homes, the Freedomites believed they were demonstrating the meaninglessness of their own possessions and effectively protesting government land ownership policies. When they burned down the homes of moderate Dukhobors, they were attempting to guilt-trip them for abandoning their religion.
According to the American Psychological Association, some people set fires for sociocultural reasons. This would certainly apply to the Freedomites. They already had a tradition of burning weapons in protests that went back to the 1890s.
And Russian farmers, like the Freedomites, had a cultural tradition of setting fires as a form of resistance that dates back to Napoleon's invasion of Russia in 1812. During the French invasion, Russian farmers set fire to their homes and fields, so the advancing French army had no food or shelter.
This scorched earth policy embedded itself into the Russian cultural consciousness, and it could have contributed to the Freedomites' willingness to burn their own homes in Canada as a form of defiance against the government.
According to the U.S. Fire Administration, extremism is one of several potential motives for arsonists. Extremists, like the Freedomites, set fires because they believe it advances their religious agendas.
And many arsonists also suffer from mental illness. According to a 1999 study published in the Journal of Forensic Sciences, quote, 90% of arsonists had recorded mental health histories, and of those, 36% had the major mental illness of schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, end quote. It's possible some of the Freedomites who were setting fires may have suffered from mental illness as well.
The Freedomites' fire setting hurt the larger Dukhobor community. American and Canadian newspapers lumped the Freedomites with the moderate Dukhobors and began to portray all Dukhobors as religious extremists. In reality, the Freedomites were no longer Dukhobors, and they numbered only a few thousand.
But their small numbers didn't stop them from escalating their terrorist activities. As if nude protests and arson weren't enough, they also became infamous for bombing power lines, bus stations, and railroads.
Despite their violent activities, the moderate Dukhobor leader, Peter Varagin, never openly condemned the Freedomites. But it's not clear if the Freedomites still respected their former religious leader. In fact, Varagin's willingness to cooperate with the Canadian government may have convinced the more extremist Freedomites that their former religious leader needed to be eliminated.
On October 29, 1924, Varagin was traveling on the Kettle Valley Railway with several government officials when a bomb exploded.
Varagin died in the blast, along with several government officials. As Canadian government officials investigated the attack, suspicion quickly fell on the one group infamous for both its bombing campaigns and its attacks on moderate Dukhobors, the Freedomites. We'll return to our story in just a moment. And now, back to cults. On October 29, 1924, a train car exploded on the Kettle Valley Railway. Dukhobor leader Peter Varagin and several Canadian government officials died instantly.
Police initially suspected the Freedomites might be responsible. They were already infamous for their arson and bombing attacks.
But Varagin's assassin was never identified, and the Freedomites escalated their attacks and nude protests in the 1930s.
In 1931, the Canadian government criminalized public nudity in an effort to curb the Freedomites' protest marches. Offenders could now go to jail for 3 years for protesting in the nude.
This didn't deter the Freedomites. In May 1932, 500 Freedomites received 3-year prison sentences for conducting nude marches. Despite these arrests, the Freedomites' nude protests, arson attacks, and bombings continued into the 1940s. On August 23, 1947, 6 Freedomites were finally arrested after a several week-long arson campaign during which they burned down over 20 homes, schools, and community centers in Kootenay Valley.
In the aftermath of World War II, many Freedomites were also fearful that a third world war was imminent. According to the New York Times, they burned down all of these buildings to emphasize the nature of their sacrificial protests against war.
The Freedomites were worried for the future, and in 1949, a man named Stephen Sorokin appeared, claiming he could save them from catastrophe.
The dark-haired Sorokin was charismatic and manipulative, and he managed to worm his way into a leadership position with the Freedomites within a few months.
The mainstream Dukhobors were perplexed by this new Freedomite leader. He wasn't raised a Freedomite or even a Dukhobor. He didn't seem to be genuine.
In fact, Sorokin was little more than a con artist. Not long after the Freedomites named him as their new leader in 1950, he stole $96,000 and left for Uruguay.
He told the Freedomites that he was going to find them a new homeland, since he knew they were unhappy in Canada. But in reality, he bought himself a farm with the Freedomites' money and was never seen again.
An author named Sima Holt eventually tracked Sorokin down and demanded to know why he stole money from a vulnerable and easily manipulated community. Sorokin smirked, and he said, quote, "I'm like the Pope. The Pope collects money. Why shouldn't I?" End quote.
By the early 1950s, the Canadian government was increasingly frustrated with the Freedomites' relentless protests and terrorist campaigns. They also feared that the Freedomites were indoctrinating their children and raising a new generation of protesters.
Freedomites refused to send their children to public schools. They believed Canadian schools inculcated children with militaristic and patriotic ideals that ran contrary to their own anti-war and anti-nationalist views.
But Canadian officials feared that the isolation of the Freedomites' children would breed extremism. They desperately wanted to get those kids into a public school and integrate them into Canadian society. So the government decided to forcibly seize children from their parents, nicknaming their plan Operation Snatch. The government sent armed police to a Freedomite camp on September 9, 1953, to conduct their first raid.
The government could not have come up with a more aggressive, psychologically damaging plan. One 8-year-old boy later recalled terrible violence he witnessed on September 9th. He first saw the Mounties, or police, lining up outside the fence bordering the Freedomite camp.
The police drank bottle after bottle of beer. They began to taunt the Freedomites, leering and throwing their beer bottles at them.
Suddenly, the police surged forward into the camp, viciously beating the adults they encountered. And the violence only became more extreme as the police forced their way into the Freedomites' prayer tent, where 100 Freedomites were praying with their children.
The police began battering the adults with their clubs. The 8-year-old boy was terrified. He and several of the other Freedomite children slipped out of the back of the tent and raced for the safety of the woods.
The boy remained in hiding for hours, frozen with panic, until some of the older Freedomite children discovered him and warned him their parents had been arrested and the children were being carted away on buses.
The terror of that day would carry over into the children's adult lives. One child later recalled, "We were frightened to death. I used to have nightmares for the longest time, and to remember it still hurts."
It's likely that some of the Freedomite children suffered from PTSD after being violently ripped away from their parents. Children who experience PTSD may display symptoms of anxiety and depression. They may have difficulty sleeping and nightmares where they relive their trauma. According to the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, trauma survivors who get PTSD are even more likely to complain of nightmares.
In total, the Canadian government snatched away 104 Freedomite children on September 9th. In the days following the seizure, word spread about a plan to confine the Freedomite children in an institution. Social workers grew alarmed.
The president of the Canadian Association of Social Workers in British Columbia warned government officials that isolating the Freedomite children from their parents and their community would endanger the children's mental health. He urged the government to keep the children and the parents together.
The Canadian government ignored this dire warning. And on September 16, 1953, the Freedomite children were sent in front of a judge who ruled to confine them in New Denver, the government-run boarding school created specifically for the Freedomite kids.
New Denver was a long, arduous drive away from the Freedomites' homes in Crestova, Grand Forks, and Gilpin. The government wanted to make it as difficult as possible for the Freedomite parents to visit their children.
Just days after being seized by the government, the Freedomite children were already suffering deeply from being separated from their parents. In the courtroom, the children sobbed inconsolably.
According to Dr. Kraft, president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, forcibly separating children from their parents can create a condition known as toxic stress response. Dr. Kraft explained to CNN, quote, toxic stress is prolonged exposure to hormones such as cortisol, epinephrine, norepinephrine, fight-or-flight hormones, and then inflammatory hormones. In a very young child, that disrupts brain development. The younger the child is, the more likely it is to really do long-term damage and short-term damage, end quote.
Dr. Julie Linton, who has examined immigrant children suffering from toxic stress after being separated from their parents, told CNN that there are several clear signs that a child is suffering from the condition. These include difficulties in sleeping and eating, as well as psychological changes.
In the short term, children suffering from toxic stress may experience higher anxiety or emotional deadening. They may have difficulties with memory, and they're more likely to have tantrums. In the long term, the effects of toxic stress syndrome can be devastating. Children are more likely to develop a learning disorder and depression. They're also at increased risk for suicide and other illnesses. American College of Physicians President Dr. Ana Maria Lopez recently warned Congress about the negative long-term effects of forcibly separating parents from children.
The kind of stress, you may infer, may be mental health stress, an impact like depression. But this also increases other health risks, including heart disease, cancer, stroke, and respiratory illnesses. The effect of this type of event will follow these children into adulthood and into their entire lives.
Unfortunately, the Canadian government ignored the warnings about the harm it was doing to the Freedomite children. And in September 1953, they shipped the children off to New Denver. It was difficult for the children to handle living in an institution where the staff members were cold and indifferent toward them.
Dr. Chandra Ghosh-Ippen, a trauma specialist, recently explained how children suffer when confined in a prison-like institution without loving caregivers.
We're doing lasting damage. Children who are placed in places that look like jails will wonder, am I bad? Why am I arrested? They will need help to deal with this. If they're placed in situations where they don't have loving care.
Freedomite parents were only allowed to visit their children at New Denver for 1 hour on the first and third Sunday of every month. But these truncated visits did little to ameliorate the children's suffering.
The Canadian government claimed that they had to isolate the Freedomite children from their parents in order to ensure they received a quality education. But it would appear the government did not really care about their education. A letter dated July 17, 1953, warned that none of the Freedomite children spoke much English. The letter writer strongly recommended that they hire Russian-speaking teachers to put the Freedomite children at ease.
The Canadian government ignored this advice. Instead, they hired an English-speaking head of New Denver on September 23, 1953. The entire staff hired that fall was fluent only in English. Unsurprisingly, the teachers' fledgling attempts to conduct trial classes in December of 1953 were a disaster. It didn't help that the traumatized children couldn't understand a word of what the teachers were saying.
Classes at New Denver officially began on January 11, 1954. But the Freedomite children continued to resist the instructors' attempts to force them to attend classes they couldn't understand.
In a letter written on January 14, 1954, an attendance officer describes entering the dormitory and discovering a group of Freedomite boys huddled in a circle, praying as a form of protest. About half the boys had stripped off their clothes to protest naked. The officers decided to target a 13-year-old boy praying with his two younger brothers.
They tried to drag the 13-year-old out first, but when the siblings resisted, an officer got physical, shoving and punching one of the young boys to force them to cooperate. This would be just one of the many acts of violence and abuse perpetrated by the instructors and staff at New Denver. Our story will continue in a moment after a brief message. Now, our story continues. On September 9, 1953, 104 Freedomite children were snatched from their parents and imprisoned at a government-created school called New Denver. Children struggled to handle life at the filthy, understaffed institution.
After classes began in January 1953, the children found it difficult to maintain their sense of individuality in this rigid, institutionalized setting. A woman who survived New Denver later remembered, quote, "I guess the hard part was being not an individual," end quote. Kevin Brown, a professor of forensic psychology and child health, explains some of the consequences of institutionalizing children in his paper, The Risk of Harm to Young Children in Institutionalized Care. Children living in group settings can become socially withdrawn or, alternatively, seek attention through self-harming and other negative behaviors.
The Canadian government refused to admit they were inflicting psychological harm on the Freedomite children. And the children brought to New Denver weren't just being traumatized by the separation from their parents. The younger children were also being bullied by the older kids.
In March 1954, a survivor, who was 8 years old at the time, remembered that he was badly bullied by the other boys and given an offensive nickname.
In late March, this child's uncle wrote to the school, trying to secure permission to bring him home. Not only did the head of the school refuse to release the child, he wouldn't even acknowledge that the child was being bullied.
In general, the director of New Denver was completely unwilling to acknowledge that the Freedomite children were being traumatized.
In a letter he sent to the Department of Child Welfare in September 1954, he insisted that the Freedomite children wouldn't suffer any long-term psychological damage from being separated from their parents.
The director was wrong. A report written by an ombudsman, or government official, investigating the experiences of the Freedomite children noted, "Sadly, it is evident that the vast majority of people who have come to us have been emotionally scarred, in the long term, by their institutional experiences in New Denver."
The staff at New Denver also did little to keep the facilities clean and sanitary for the Freedomite children. On April 13, 1955, a welfare official did an inspection of the premises and noted that the kitchen was the only clean room in the facility. The dormitories were filthy.
Despite the official's report, the staff failed to make any improvements to the children's living conditions.
They were understaffed at New Denver and ill-prepared to keep up with maintenance. According to a Department of Child Welfare letter written on September 21, 1955, there were only 33 staff members caring for 80 to 130 children.
By September, living conditions for the Freedomite children were atrocious. A local magistrate visited the grounds and wrote a letter on September 26, 1955, noting a preponderance of smashed windows and broken doors. The buildings were generally filthy and poorly maintained.
From the fall of 1955 to the early months of 1956, the Freedomite children's living conditions grew increasingly unsanitary, and the children themselves were miserable.
By the spring of 1956, around 80 to 130 Freedomite children were still imprisoned at New Denver. Perhaps in an effort to improve conditions at New Denver, the Canadian government appointed a new head of the school on April 1, 1956. But this new school head soon transformed the institution into an even more hellish prison for the Freedomite children.
The new director fired the school's four janitors and made the Freedomite kids clean the school buildings and dormitories instead. He also used the children as a free maid service and forced them to clean his house. They didn't even get holidays off.
In June 1956, the director introduced new draconian measures to restrict the Freedomite parents' ability to visit their children. He decided to build a fence around the entire institution. Parents were now only allowed to see their children through the wire fence. The children felt like prisoners or zoo animals, stripped of their humanity. Linda Essex, a survivor, remembered, "We were like monkeys hanging on a wire, kissing our parents through the wire."
As if the fence wasn't bad enough, the staff also became increasingly abusive. On February 18, 1957, the New Denver director admitted in an interview that he beat children with a strap to get them to behave.
Studies have increasingly shown that corporal punishment negatively affects children's mental health. According to the American Psychological Association, spanking can make children more aggressive and antisocial.
But this didn't stop the staff from beating the children for years. and the abuse escalated far beyond beatings. On July 22nd, a Freedomite parent sent a letter to the head of New Denver, horrified that an instructor had beaten their child so badly that several of the child's teeth were broken. The director knew about the incident, but apparently little was done about the abuse.
In yet another instance of abuse, a staff member interrupted a game of basketball that the Freedomite children were playing. He grabbed one boy and slammed his head repeatedly into the wall.
The director also authorized staff to steal food and packages from the Freedomite children. In September of 1957, he wrote a report claiming that he needed to confiscate care packages because New Denver had a rat infestation. But in reality, the staff was just hoarding the children's food and eating it themselves.
Meanwhile, the Canadian government was selling off the land that they had confiscated from the Freedomites, leaving them in a constant state of unrest. Their protests seemed to have curbed during the time, only encouraging the government to maintain the new status quo.
Back at New Denver, the staff continued abusing the Freedomite children well into 1958. Some of the staff members sexually abused the children as well.
A survivor who was only 11 when she was snatched from her parents vividly remembered the physical and sexual abuse she suffered at the instructor's hands at New Denver. She described how one instructor hit and kicked girls for resting during gym classes. Another instructor repeatedly forced her into a dark corner, turned off the lights, then groped and sexually assaulted her.
In addition to abusing the children, the staff at New Denver failed to provide the kids with proper medical care. For example, on March 8, 1958, a magistrate sent a letter to the government discussing an instance where the school had failed to properly treat a Freedomite boy who had been hospitalized four times with pneumonia since 1956. It turned out the boy had a tumor in his lung that they failed to treat.
A group of Freedomite mothers grew frustrated as school officials ignored their complaints about the child abuse for years. So they reported the abuse to the Nelson Daily News in the spring of 1958. The mothers described many terrible instances of abuse, including one occasion where a staff member used a board with nails hammered into it to beat a young child.
But when the newspaper interviewed the staff at New Denver for a March 18th article, they didn't promise to change their behavior. Instead, they made excuses to justify the abuse.
Though the head of New Denver wouldn't admit it publicly, he was very aware at this point that his staff was abusive and neglectful. In March of 1958, he wrote a surprisingly honest letter to the Department of Education, admitting that the children needed new caretakers at New Denver who were actually kind and affectionate.
It's unclear why the director suddenly began caring about the children's mental health, but this letter was too little, too late. 200 Freedomite children had already suffered the staff's abuse for years.
Even though a 1953 federal law required Canadian schools like New Denver to offer the children psychological counseling, the head of New Denver never provided counselors or therapists for the Freedomite children in 1958.
A year later, in July 1959, a group of 60 Freedomite mothers became fed up with the sect's inability to get their children back. They took over leadership of the Freedomites and began a three-day campaign to win their children's freedom.
The Freedomite mothers explained to a Canadian education board that they would accept their children attending public school under a few conditions. They didn't want their kids taught military history, since that went against their pacifist beliefs. And they also wanted their girls to be allowed to wear their traditional conservative dress, a babushka, or headscarf, and long skirts.
The board agreed to these conditions. Pleased, the Freedomites were finally willing to send their kids to Canadian schools. On July 31st, the mothers swore a traditional Christian oath of water, salt, and bread, and promised to send their kids to public school. In return, Canadian officials agreed to release the 77 children still imprisoned in New Denver.
On August 2, 1959, the Canadian government finally freed the 77 Freedomite children. But New Denver had traumatized the Freedomite children, and many of the 77 hadn't been home in 5 years. The Canadian government still made no effort to offer the Freedomite children access to therapists or counselors.
Regardless, the Freedomites complied with the government's demand and sent their children to public school. According to a New York Times article written a year later on July 4, 1960, the Freedomite children were acclimating well to Canadian schools.
What the article didn't mention was that many of these children were still deeply traumatized by their experience at New Denver. These psychological scars would stay with them well into adulthood.
But as the Freedomite children integrated into Canadian schools, a small group of Freedomite leaders remained furious at the Canadian government. And in the early 1960s, they began a new terrorism campaign.
On December 10, 1961, a group of Freedomites used 30 sticks of dynamite to blow up a section of railroad near one of their settlements in British Columbia. No one died, but it caused extensive damage to the railroad and held up important shipments for over 2 days.
In March 1962, the Freedomites committed their most costly act of terrorism to date, when a group of Freedomite men blew up a $50 million transmission tower. Again, no one died, but a local mine had to close, and 1,000 Canadians lost their jobs. According to the New York Times article written on March 11th, it was the Freedomites' worst act of terrorism in their 30 years of arson and bombing attacks.
By March 23rd, the Canadian government had arrested 20 Freedomite men and sentenced them to prison for the most recent string of bombings. A day later, on March 24th, the government arrested an additional 40 Freedomite leaders.
3 months later, on June 8th, a group of Freedomite women protested the imprisonment of their leaders by setting fire to 50 of their plywood homes in Christova. Once again, they were sacrificing their homes to demonstrate their freedom from the material world.
By June 10th, the Freedomite women had burned down 91 homes and allegedly planned to burn down their entire village. The Canadian government sent additional police in an attempt to put a stop to the arson and quell the unrest.
But the Freedomite women kept up their arson campaign. By June 17th, they had burned down 132 homes. By June 22nd, the fires were still burning. Over 400 women and children were living in tents.
But this wasn't enough to quench the Freedomite women's desire to protest. And in September of 1962, a Freedomite named Fanny Storgoff rose to international fame as their leader. She had immigrated to Canada as a toddler and grown up in Vancouver before moving to the Freedomite village in Crestova with her husband.
A compelling and charismatic leader, Fanny guided 1,000 Freedomites through a year-long march across Canada to Agassiz by the coast, where they formed a new settlement. A Canadian police officer who accompanied the march to help keep order later recalled, quote, "If Fanny had decided to run a hospital or a department store, or almost anything, she would have been a success. She might have been a great woman if the circumstances had been different," end quote.
But Fanny died of cancer just 2 years later, on September 12, 1964, at age 56.
No Freedomite leaders rose to prominence after Fanny's death, perhaps because so many had been jailed in the early 1960s.
In 1980, the Canadian authorities established a committee to resolve issues with the Freedomites. Their goal was to bring an end to the Freedomites' arson and terrorism campaign by improving the Freedomites' relationship with the Canadian government and the other Doukhobor sects.
Throughout the 1980s, the committee held public hearings and examined the Freedomites' history to help resolve the sects' conflicts. The committee was eventually effective. The Freedomites' terrorism campaign died out, and the Freedomites integrated back into the larger Doukhobor community in the 1980s. Essentially dissolving the once infamous cult.
But the now grown survivors of New Denver were still haunted by the abuses they suffered from 1953 to 1959. In the 1990s, 48 survivors filed a lawsuit against the Canadian government asking for compensation for their suffering.
In 1999, an ombudsman report recommended that the Canadian government apologize to the Freedomites and offer them compensation for the abuse they endured.
Unfortunately, the government never offered any compensation. The lawsuits never recovered any damages, and the Canadian government refused to do so much as apologize to the New Denver survivors.
Instead, Canadian Attorney General Jeff Plante offered a statement in October 2004, justifying the government's internment of 200 children by reminding his audience of the attacks that the Freedomite adults were leading against the Canadian community in the 1950s. He refused to apologize to the New Denver survivors, but offered his regrets on behalf of the Canadian government.
Unsurprisingly, this non-apology by the government left many of the survivors disappointed and frustrated. After Plante's speech in October 2004, survivor Linda Essex told reporters, "They took us from our parents because they said they wanted to protect us, but our protectors abused us. There was no love, no warmth, just fear."
Although the New Denver survivors were not offered an apology in 2004, they were finally offered counseling services through the Canadian government's Ministry of Children and Family Development.
Perhaps this will help the New Denver survivors and descendants of the Freedomites overcome the abuse and neglect they endured at the hands of their own government. And hopefully, increased awareness of the Freedomite children's suffering can help prevent similar atrocities in the future. Thanks again for tuning in to Cults.
If you want to listen to any previous episodes of Cults, you can find them on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify, or on our website, parcast.com, spelled parcast.com.
If you like what you hear, please leave a 5-star review or tell us what you think on social media. We're on Facebook and Instagram as @Parcast and Twitter @ParcastNetwork.
It seems simple, but it really helps our show.
See you next time. Cults was created by Max Cutler and is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Kenny Hobbs, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire, Carly Madden, and Jeanette Manning. Cults is written by Samantha Gourash and Kenneth Martin, and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson.